How is everybody? Awake and ready. How feels everybody?
Awake and ready.
Are you ready for death? Paradoxical as it may seem, if you aren't ready for death, you aren't ready for life either. It's like that song of mine, Nightingale, Nightingale, sing of joy through the night. Teach all men how to spin clouds of gloom into light. Without silence, what is song? Without night, where is dawn? Were it not for men's woes, who would smile at a rose? It's out of silence that song comes. It's out of night that dawn comes. Without an ability to rest in nothingness, there can't ever be really the enjoyment of things either. As it says in the Upanishads, I forget which one now, a person should live in this world without attachment to anything and then wish to live 100 years enjoying it. And in fact, one can only enjoy when one isn't attached. One can really succeed only when one is not attached to the results of one's effort. That those people who are really strongly committed to anything or bound by anything are to that extent limited from everything else. It's said that in biology, over-specialization makes it more difficult for a species to adapt. That, for example, I believe the koala bear will only eat the eucalyptus leaf, and it wouldn't be able to live anywhere where there weren't eucalyptus plants. This place is a very low possibility of survival in case of any great change. Man is a very adaptable creature, and because of that we find him recently they found a village of Christians so far in the north of Siberia that no one even knew they existed. They'd been there 50 years, just cut off completely from everyone. Man can live in extraordinarily diverse circumstances. But unless we are able to pull back from everything and realize that nothing is really ourself, we find that sooner or later life breaks us. And as in fact, as you look at the faces of people as they grow older, usually you find written on their faces the pains of disappointment, the pains of broken dreams, the things that they had hoped would be true and proved not to be true, the things they committed themselves to, and then life gave them something different. And so, with disappointment and hurt, they die of broken hearts and broken spirits. I got a letter the other day from somebody. You read my answer in the minutes a week ago. The person who was just completely broken in his faith in God and the goodness of life and everything, basically because his own body is suffering. Those people who are able to come up smiling in all tests, who are able to adapt to everything that comes to them, they are the heroes. And they gain that heroism by the ability, first of all, to detach themselves from everything and realize that I am not that. Courage, in its original meaning, is to have heart. To have a heart for something is possible. They say that courage is a capital investment that diminishes with experience. It's a very interesting definition. That the more you suffer pain, the more you think, oh, not that again. And thus people may finally become fearful. But to have a heart for things, and to continue to have a heart for things, and to continue to be courageous, is possible if, in fact, you rest within yourself. You are completely content within yourself, and you know that this is all that really is yours, is what you are, and everything else can change. In this way, you can continue to have a heart for everything. For example, a person is deeply hurt by someone, or a group of people. And The usual human tendency, unfortunately, is to become bitter, to hate them, to say, well, I will never love anyone else again because I don't want to be hurt again. And thus it is that people gradually build walls around their hearts to the point where they lose the ability to love. If, however, such a person were to discriminate, as a few people do, and realize under such circumstances that he would be losing twice if, after being hurt, he hates or refuses to love. Because only when we know how to love can we know what joy is. Only when we can overcome hatred can we overcome one of the great pains in life. Because hatred not only hurts the object of its hatred, much more it hurts the person who does the hating. And so you lose twice. You're hurt by someone else, and then you're hurt by yourself because of a negative reaction. And so a person who says, well, I have control over my feeling. I don't have to worry about how other people feel toward me. I don't have to feel upset or hateful just because they hate me. If a person can have that kind of freedom in his heart, then he can have heart, have the courage to love again and again and again, because he knows that it's unconditional. He knows that the love that he feels in his heart is his own to give, and no one has the power to take that away from him. This is possible only when we have detached ourselves from attachment to outward circumstances, people, things, the way the world chooses to treat us. That's its business. The way we choose to treat the world, that's our business. And if we treat it with the right kind of spirit, then we gain, even if nobody else gains. Even if when we love others, they don't love back. It's their loss, but it needn't be ours. In this way, we see again and again, when Jesus said that I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly, he wasn't talking about things and new sofas and all the things that people like to surround themselves with. He was talking about this inner life of the Spirit. And this kind of life is possible only when we have that detachment that makes it possible for us to say, awake and ready, yes, even for death. Because all of life is in fact a preparation for that final exam. It's even a salutary thing sometimes. I remember a few years ago I was taking a bath, a shower, and I just suddenly was thinking, this arm that I'm washing is someday just going to be dust. It's sort of a surprising thought. You think, yes, death, someday I'll be gone, all those things, but it's sort of there. But you think, this arm that I'm washing right now, this body that is so much a part of my human consciousness, you needn't feel morbid about this because it's a reality, and you may as well learn how to face it. All of life is a preparation for that final exam. What will happen when you go? Will you be able to go freely and say, it's all right because I don't belong to this body? Like yogis who go into deep meditation and see that they aren't this body. Like people many times on the operating table who have suddenly found themselves above their body, looking down at it. Been able to describe what happened so it wasn't just a dream, an imagination. And yet they knew for a fact that they weren't a part of their body. They were just living in that body. When you have that kind of freedom, will you be able to go on, or will you hang on here? Will you just be a ghost or a earthbound spirit? With all the traveling I was doing, I used to say that the only way I'd ever get to enjoy my house would be to come back and haunt it. But a lot of people actually have that kind of attachment that holds them down here. How will you go? It's a very, very important question, because you won't be here that long and you just never know when you will be gone. It's such a surprising thing when we encounter death in someone close enough to us for us to know how very real and vital that person was, and then suddenly, where is he? I remember when Hanul died. He's the only member of Ananda so far who has died. And it looked it was amazing. That body that I was so used to thinking of as Hanul was just obviously no longer Hanul. It was sort of like an insect that has shed like a butterfly that it has shed its little caterpillar form, and it's just there a shell, not real at all. You know that's not Hanul. Or like one time a group of the disciples were all standing outside Master's tomb at Forest Lawn, and some of them were weeping. This was just shortly after his passing. And Louise Royston said she felt him standing right beside her and heard him say, "I'm not in there." How will you go? This is one of the most important questions you can ask. And it's not a morbid question, nor is it merely a question related to something that will happen in the future. The ability to face that question with the right spirit determines also your ability to face the realities of life right now. Because the more attached you are, the less you will be able to enjoy even the goods of this world. The less attached you are, and that means ultimately the more ready you are to just say, "It doesn't matter, I can go." The more ready you are, the more able you will be to enjoy this world too. You'll be free. Just like that beautiful example of the skier, who, if he's really centered in himself and not committed to going one direction or another, can easily turn left or right as he goes down the hill, can easily avoid that tree or that bump, can easily stop when he needs to, go faster when he needs to. The same thing is true with life, that when we have that freedom to be able, just even as a sort of small, minor preparation for death, think of yourself as no longer having anything that you have right now. Supposing, like those business tycoons who woke up suddenly on an October morning in 1929, realizing that they had suddenly lost everything they owned, how would you feel if suddenly everything that you considered yours were taken away from you, but you still had your body? Would you sit there weeping and wailing? I remember when we lost our temple back in 1970. It was burned down. And I went into a store where they have the school up here close by. And I was singing something, and the lady, the proprietress, was a French lady. And she said, "My goodness, you're singing." And I said, "Well, why not? I've lost a temple. I haven't lost my voice." And she said, "My goodness, when we lost our house, for 6 months I was weeping." I was thinking, "My goodness, 6 months. But you're smiling now. Why waste those 6 months? Why take 6 months to learn a lesson you're going to have to learn anyway, sooner or later?" And yet there are some people who never do learn their lesson. Many years later, they're still sort of grumbling bitterly because of something that they lost, or somebody who didn't treat them fairly. It's sort of like a lady that came to Master and was talking about this operation she'd had, and the harrowing details and the dreadful pain. And he was saying it sounded as if this was something she'd had last week. He said, "When did you have it?" She said, 20 years ago. 20 years of resuffering that operation. If we can be free right now, we'll be able to enjoy whatever comes. And in all circumstances, we'll find that we can be what we only can be ever, our true self. Because it's so obvious as to be a truism, and yet it's something we don't normally think about. We came naked into this world. We had nothing. And when we leave this world, we will also have nothing. And everything that we've built now in this world won't be ours. The only thing that will be ours is the character that we have developed in the process of dealing with the challenges of life. That we take with us. It would be good to consider what death really is about, so that we don't only consider the attitude of facing the inevitable with a stoical attitude and so on. I feel sad for people who don't believe in a life after death, because, yes, I suppose it's possible to be stoical, but still, the thought of going into nothingness, there must be something within us that rebels against that thought. There is this intuition of immortality, which even the communists, with all their atheism, can't get away from. What they do is give up their lives for this big cause, but that's their immortality. Nobody can get away from this feeling that You're living for something bigger than yourself, something that will last longer than you, something that will have a lasting effect. We can't get away from it, basically, because it's our own inner reality. When God created the universe, He created three phases of the universe, or He projected His creation in three phases. The first was that out of that undifferentiated consciousness that was the Spirit, He began moving that consciousness and thinking. And those thoughts took on shape or direction. And it was sort of like a blueprint for the rest of creation. It was all in idea, but He sort of like when you think to build something or write something or paint something, first of all you have it in your mind and you think, well, let's see now, I think I'll do it this way and that way. And even the thought is a reality. The thought too, I remember discussions that we've had about things that we would do, which we probably never will do, but the very discussion was memorable. I remember a discussion that some of us had at my house a few years ago about the retreat here, and I don't suppose we'll ever be able to get the money together to do it as beautifully as we planned it, and we knew we probably wouldn't, but it was such fun talking anyway. And the idea of it had its own reality. It had its own beauty. In fact, in some ways, it was much more beautiful because it was so easy to build that big tower there and like this. This is the first stage of creation, and it's a whole universe of thought. Ideational universe, the causal universe. It's ideational, obviously. It's causal also because it's on the basis of that idea that everything else was projected. You never are able to do anything unless you first have the idea that then becomes projected as what? Energy. Before you get the thing itself, you have energy. And so it is that when you have an idea and it's strongly fixed enough in your mind and clear enough, then you start putting out the energy to objectify that idea. And that energy has a reality too. And even if you never do, there are some people who try very hard to accomplish things, but never succeed in actually accomplishing them. Maybe their ideal was too high, maybe it was too grandiose. Nevertheless, the energy that they put out also has its own reality and its own reward. Because sometimes, even as I've said on other occasions, even failure can be a victory if you put out enough energy towards success. Mere failure is not necessarily victory. I was told a delightful story by David Spangler about somebody who was trying to build some sort of city of the future. It looked practically astral in its drawings and so on, and he was trying to get funds together. Obviously just a dreamer, not somebody who could do anything. And he wanted to put on a big show in the Cow Palace, and I believe they were going to get the Beatles and the everybody they could think of to put on this big show to raise funds. And they got David Spangler involved, and he was right close by, and so he said yes. And he didn't do very much, but he agreed to come and talk. And so finally the big event, you know how big the Cow Palace is, if you don't, it's about the size of a football field. It's huge. And anyway, the event finally came. The people present were the man, his wife, David Spangler, and a couple of people from a TV station taking pictures. And this man, that was all, in the whole Cow Palace. And this man was running up and down the aisle joyfully saying, "It's a success! It's a success!" Well, this kind of energy is not necessarily going to produce the astral universe. But that kind of energy which really moves out in a strong way toward overcoming obstacles, toward meeting challenges, toward creating and materializing what you want, that kind of energy is a very real thing, and even if it doesn't bear fruit because of the nature of the world, it will bear real fruit in your own self. It will change you. It will make you a different person. And sometimes to fail in that way is much better than to succeed sort of just on the strength of good karma. That's why it says in the Bhagavad Gita, to fail in your own duty is better than to succeed in someone else's. We could give an example of that. Supposing you have somebody like, somebody with enough talent to be an Einstein, let's say, to make it very obvious. And he decides, gosh, but it's too much trouble, I think I'll be a janitor. He might, in fact, be a very successful janitor. But what growth would there be in it for him? It would be an absurd vocation. So it is that even if he hadn't succeeded in finding the theory of relativity, but he put out the energy to look for it, he would have done better doing that than saying, well, what's the use? I probably couldn't find it anyway. Let me be a janitor. The energy that we put out has its own reality, its own reward. And on a cosmic level, that energy is a definite stage of creation, which is called the astral universe. And then the final stage of that is the end result, the materialized sort of frozen idea, which is our material universe. Now, it's very important to understand, if we want to understand this whole picture, that every projection, every further projection from this center is a manifestation of that center. It's not something different or new. That the fields and trees and beauties of this world are projections of a prototype that exists in energy already. In other words, the world that exists behind space, behind the darkness of closed eyes, behind this material universe, that world is very similar to this world. It's a world, however, of light. It's a world where the vibrations are... it's a world of vibration, and thus these vibrations, because there is much more freedom, these vibrations automatically create their own magnetism so that the different regions of that world are much more pronounced, much more differentiated. This world is sort of like a, to use an absurd example, you could think of a vaudeville act, all sort of going in a line, and suddenly the first one hits a wall, and the next one hits him, and the third hits him, and they all sort of fall in a heap together. This world represents the dead end of all that project, all that energy. And so all the vibrations that are so diverse and separate here suddenly sort of pile up on each other in this world. And you have in this world a mixture of a mixture of criminals and saints, of artists and businessmen, of people who are selfish and people who are living only for others, of people who are violent and full of hate, of people who love and are full of kindness. And an incredible mixture. And yet, even here in this world, we find that it's amazing the different worlds we live in. How you can go down the street and just... In fact, I was thinking of getting together a slideshow of people's faces. I've started it, but I need more pictures, I think. I was thinking of calling it Different Worlds. And just showing what different worlds are manifest, even in the faces of people. As you look at them, the same world, the same planet, and yet each one lives in his own little universe. Even in a home, you'll find, I remember reading the story of Saint Margaret, how she was brought up in a home with a very hateful aunt, I believe it was, I'm not sure now. But anyway, here was this very loving, forgiving, kind girl, and her own close relative, who lived with her all the time, was only seeing evil in what she was doing, because she herself was evil, was only seeing selfishness in her very generosity, that what are you trying to do, show me up, and so on, living in a completely different world, although at such close quarters. The astral world is a place where it's much more harmonious, much more homogeneous. There are regions for some of those people. It's sort of like, even in... Even in this world, the fish can't come out of water. Man can't breathe where the eagles can fly. Even here we find that there are different atmospheres where people just don't feel, whether for obvious reasons or subtle ones, at home. I remember a couple of people at our church in Hollywood when we all chanted Om. These people had to leave. They couldn't stand it. There are some people who just can't stand rock music. I'm one of them. It's just... It's just painful. And I was mentioning this to somebody who loves rock music, and I was saying, have you ever listened to Mozart? Yeah, he's dead. It all depends on your vibrations, on your consciousness. You get drawn to that place that you really belong in. Well, at the time of death, what happens is, first of all, you leave your body in the same way that you entered it. The beginning of the physical body is when the sperm and ovum unite, and from that point they begin at the medulla. This is the seat of life in the body, the medulla oblongata at the base of the brain. It's from here that it's the only part of the body that you couldn't possibly operate on. It's the seat of life. And it's through here that we draw energy into the body. From there, it goes out to create the spine, the brain, and then out into the nervous system, and finally the whole body is formed. Well, when you die, the energy goes back in the opposite direction. First of all, it withdraws from the outside of the body into the spine. At that time, you're not necessarily dead. And a strong effort of will on your own part even could bring you back into the body. This is one reason why cremation is a good thing, that when they buried people, it happened that people would come back to life in the coffin. And that's why they have that expression of turning over in his grave, because they opened coffins and found people. Imagine coming back to life and finding that you were in your coffin. It would be scary. Cremation is at least a means of, if you're going to go, you might as well get it over with completely. There are a number of curious stories. There was one of a story that Yogananda told of a man in India who died, and he was wearing a very expensive diamond ring. And a thief came and saw this body and thought, well, he won't need that ring anymore, and started to take it off his finger. And the man was still enough in his body to be aware of what was happening. And he was so outraged that somebody would steal this diamond ring that with a violent effort he came back to life. The senses shut off one by one. The last sense to go is the sense of hearing. I think that this is a strong argument against, unfortunately, against leaving your eyes to medicine for the sake of others. Because if there's still life in the eye, even though the body's dead, if there's still life in the eye, it's probably because you haven't completely withdrawn the energy from it yet. And it would be a little distracting, wouldn't it? Here you are getting ready to face your Creator, and suddenly there's somebody digging away at your eye. Personally, I wouldn't recommend it. The sense of hearing is the last one to go. And it's possible when a person has gone, remember, you won't leave your body until you say, I'm going. And it's happened quite often. This is a story also in a case in point. Yogananda told about a couple, they weren't married, they were brother and sister, that took his classes in Chicago, I think it was, and the brother was in the hospital and died. And the doctor said, well, he's dead. The sister said, no, it isn't so. And so she called into his right ear and just kept saying to him, Swamiji says, he was called Swamiji in those days, Swamiji says that you won't go until you want to go, and I need you. You must come back. You don't have to go. And after a few minutes, he sat up, opened his eyes, and he was alive again. And he said that when he heard the doctor say it was all over, he gave up. They thought he was already gone, but he heard them say it, and he gave up. And then I heard your voice calling to me as if from a long, long way away. And then I was drawn by your love, and so here I am again. But it's important to realize that when people are lying apparently dead, that they may not have left their bodies yet, and what you say can determine whether they actually go or not. And it can also help determine how they go. That's even more important, because usually when you seem dead, you are dead. But how you go, how you prepare yourself for the divine. A very good preparation would be every day to give it all back to God. Every night when you go to bed, just say, everything that I own, everything that I am is yours. And in your meditations, a very good practice would be to build a fire mentally and just cast everything into that fire. None of it is I. None of it is mine. I am just free. I am eternal. With that consciousness, when the time to go comes, that's an interesting sentence, then you'll be able to go very easily. When you die, the energy begins to withdraw. And this is a very interesting thing that has come out in modern times, in about the last decade, with books like Life After Life and the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and so on, where people don't just hear one interesting story that may have come their way in the course of their own contacts, but these stories have been gathered by people who have been who have seen it, or maybe they've been doctors and lived with it, or maybe they made a project and went around talking to people to get their own experiences. And again, we find very interesting stories come out, and a great deal of corroboration among those stories. Most people, when they go into unconsciousness. Most people are so materialistic, it's like a fish coming out of water. It can't handle the air, and it dies. But those people who are somewhat conscious, those people who have developed some intuition, and those who meditate, this is the other thing that's very important. Deep meditation, daily meditation, develops the intuition, develops the ability, the awareness of a life that is behind this physical life. And in that awareness, you will be able to make the transition more easily. In fact, finally, to be able to leave your body consciously in meditation means that at the time of death you just go consciously. And there isn't any break, any loss of consciousness, any loss of contact. Otherwise, people normally, there is some loss. The memory is there, or it will come back to them after a bit. For example, if you dream of relatives who have died, it may well be, Master said, that they are coming back to help you in some way or to work something out with you. It may well be a real dream, particularly if it has a very strong sense of reality. So those relatives may remember, or the bond may be very strong. But I remember the story that Master told of the mother of one of his disciples, Woody. Her nickname was Margaret Wood. And the mother died, and Master went into meditation to find her. I believe he'd promised to do so, but I'm not sure. Anyway, he saw her in the astral world being led by an angel away from where she was, where he was. And he called to her, and she turned around and didn't recognize him. And then he just touched her, and suddenly she remembered. And she opened up her dress and showed him that the cancer that she'd died from was gone. She said, "You see, it's all gone." But at first she didn't remember. Then she said, "I'll never forget you again." And so that transition, for most people, unless they meditate deeply, will be a transition into a kind of unconsciousness. And then they pick up a new kind of life, depending on how aware they are. And in that new life, they may sort of vaguely remember or be drawn back just even by the soul. Remember how the soul of the deer came to Master in a dream and asked him to release him? So the deer wouldn't have known that, but the soul is always conscious. So it could even be on a soul level. I know that sometimes people tell me that I came and told them something that I'd in fact been wanting to tell them, but I wasn't aware of coming to them in the dream or however they saw me. My soul probably did that. It was on another level where I was able to give that kind of help. And so also even those relatives who come back, it may be more on that higher level that they're able to come back and remember. To really have a clear transition, you must meditate deeply. Now, when you go, the energy, as I said, withdraws from the senses, first of all, into the spine. And then the experience that people have had, the usual experiences, because there have been other kinds of experiences, depending on the level of awareness, that have been much more refined. But the experience that everyone who has retained some consciousness of it, and that's by no means all, but everyone who has retained it, and that's a large number of people, has remembered going through a long tunnel. That tunnel is the spine. It's the Sushumna. And the energy goes up through that tunnel toward the medulla, which is reflected here in the spiritual eye. And you will go outward through the medulla or forward through the spiritual eye, depending on your awareness. It amounts to the same thing, but one will be aware and the other will be non-aware. And you will go out into that realm, which in the beginning, because the ordinary person may not be very much aware, he may see a light for a while. In fact, most people don't. But the experience that people have had going through this tunnel very often does end in seeing a light at the end of that tunnel and going into that light. A very interesting thing to me personally is that not only do they feel, which is a very common experience, universal practically, among those who have brought their memory this far after coming back to the body and being awakened from their operation or their death-like trance or whatever it might be, that there is a being there who is in the position of sort of summing up their lives for them. And the thing that intrigues me is that this being is on their side. He's not a cold judge. He's not like the God figure in the Last Judgment of Michelangelo, who's sort of like this, ready to throw them all hatefully into hell, furiously into hell. Michelangelo managed to paint one of his great enemies in the corner of the lowest hell there. But the experience is that it's not a judgmental kind of thing. It's more like your friend, like saying, well, you blew that one, didn't you, kind of thing. But it's wanting to help you to grow. And what people do at this time, very frequently, the experience that you've heard about of suddenly seeing your whole life, this is the normal thing, that you see your whole life in review and you see it in a very different perspective from that which you see while living through it or that which you see with society's judgments. You see that things that seemed important are not important, and things that may not have seemed important really are. All of them relate to the spiritual quality in yourself. Those things which help you to learn, to grow. In fact, a curious thing in one of the books that I've read on the subject of what people have understood from their life after life experience is that we're here to learn. And so the author said we should read everything that we can. He thought learning meant book learning, intellectual knowledge. But learning in this sense means entirely not the baggage that you accumulate intellectually, but the qualities that you, the wisdom that you acquire. You learn how to love above all. This is the great lesson of life. This is what people come down into this world again and again to learn. How to love unconditionally. How to love no matter how you're treated. How to love without self-interest. and how to be joyful under all circumstances, how to forgive, how to be calm even under exciting circumstances, anguishing moments, and so on. All these are the real lessons, and when we've learned those properly, then we may become free, because we don't have to come back to this world forever. The thing that determines whether you come back here or not, Yogananda used to put it in a very sort of light way when he said that if you die wanting apple pie, they don't serve it in heaven, and so you have to come back here. If you die wanting to drive a car, you don't need cars in heaven. In other words, your material desires have to be fulfilled on the material plane. But desires for such things as beautiful music and lovely colors and so on, those can be fulfilled better there. So you don't have to come back for those. Those desires can be worked out on the astral plane. But the kinds of material desires you have determine when you come back, whether you come back, and where you come back. The intensity of those desires, if you've been accustomed to smoking constantly, for example, you may want to come back immediately. Some people come back instantly. They're no sooner gone than they find another body and dash back. What determines our coming back is the strength of our desires, the quality of our desires. If you have, for example, if you like curry, you'll be born in India. If you like apple pie, you'll be born in America, that kind of thing. Yogananda told this in sort of a light way, and I was so amused to see one of the monks at Mount Washington eating curry. And I said to him, "But I thought you didn't like curry." He said, "Yes, I don't, but I'm trying to like it because I want to be born in India." Well, of course, it's not quite that simple, but anyway, the more you can overcome your desires, the more your desire is of the subtler type, the more free you will be to leave the body after you go. The more you cling to this body, the more difficult it will be to leave it. Incidentally, this is a very important aspect of the whole subject, that when somebody who is close to you dies, then don't hang on to him with excessive grief, because your attachment too can hold him down. He may want to soar, but because you long for him, he feels sort of called to you. He feels as if, well, how can I leave him? Be loving enough to be able to give freedom to those who have gone, to send them love, to send them the freedom to soar in their new way of life. This is very important, to send your blessings. When my father died in March, I asked the minister if we could all just sit quiet for a minute and pray and send our love to my father. And he said, "Oh, that's a good idea. I've heard of meditation. I think it's a good thing." And he didn't have the courage to do it right. All he could get us to do was sit quiet and think about him. This thought of sending love to somebody who maybe he didn't even believe he exists anymore, I don't know. But isn't that strange in a church? You'd think that there at least that wouldn't be so hard, especially when he was open to the idea. But he didn't have the courage to do something so different. And why should it be different? Why shouldn't we understand this automatically? The body isn't you. When you leave this world, you have your own lessons to learn, your own freedom to find. And anything that we can do to help you in that must surely be important. The consciousness with which you go is very important. It determines how free you will be there. It determines where you will go. It determines even whether you come back. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says that even at the moment of death, if you can have the thought of God and be just want only him and offer yourself to him, even at that very moment you can be saved. What does salvation mean? Essentially, it means, in this context, freedom from the need to come back to this plane of existence. You go on that plane and you work on that plane to further your salvation. But even at that moment of death, I remember a student of Master's, an old man, Mr. Brockway, he was an architect. I remember him in the hospital there in Los Angeles just shortly before he died. And knowing that he was dying, he was sort of reviewing his life. And he said, "I've done many bad things in my life." And I said this, I reported this to Master later. And Master shook his head sadly. He said he shouldn't have said that. To go with regret for what you were, to go with regret for the wrong things you did, this is to cling to that. You need to say, "No, it's yours, God. I give it to you. I am yours." There's a book that I've read of a Catholic nun who had the power, apparently, to go into the astral world, or in a state of vision, to be able to see souls in the astral world. And the interesting thing about it was that many of the people she met there, whose names she would be given, would be people she didn't know from Adam, and yet they would turn out to be people who had actually lived in this world at the time that she was told they had lived. So, people in some distant village and so on. Anyway, what intrigued me particularly, you see, the Catholics have so much of this consciousness of sin and always trying to repent from things that they've done, which, if not done in the right spirit, tends to emphasize what you did instead of to emphasize your freedom from what you did. Really, to repent means to let go of it. But many of these people were in low states of existence over there because of some little sin that they had clung to. There was some nun who presumably must have been a pretty good person to have devoted her life to God, but she wasn't totally obedient to her superior. And because of that lack of obedience, she was in some lower state. Why? The very fact that she tried means a lot. I think she died with that consciousness, if this is a true story. I think it must be only that she died with that consciousness of sin. I think Master would have said she shouldn't have thought like that. You go with that thought, and then you naturally, that becomes your reality, that becomes important to you. When you go, when the time of death comes, you should be so free in your consciousness that you say, "I give it all to you. Everything that I am, everything that I've done, it's yours. I am yours, naughty or good, Mother, I am your child." If we can go in that consciousness, then we can go free. It doesn't take a long time to become free. It takes a lot of freedom of energy, freedom of consciousness. If you can really go with that thought, then you will go into that region. So work on it now. What is that world like? Well, it's like this world, only much more beautiful. This world is well, you've seen the difference between prints and slides, haven't you? You see a picture on a slide screen, and it's full of life because there's light on it. And you see that same picture in a print, and it looks dull because it's only shining with reflected light. The same thing is true, but much more sensitively so, in comparison between these two worlds, because that world, it's not reflected light, everything is light. Everything is made of light. And so the beauty there is far more intense than here. The natural beauty, there isn't the kind of pollution that we find here with our freeways and wilting plants and all that. In that world, it's not like that, simply because it's closer to the source. It has life instead of merely being reflected. And so that world, in a purely physical way, is far, far more attractive than this world, with beautiful rainbow lights, with beautiful rivers and streams, and everything. It's just those who have gone there and described it have always described it in these terms, unless they happen to go to the wrong place. Sometimes we hear a little bit of that. But it's curious, in the lives of many people, there is a deeper than conscious memory of that. I've always had that kind of memory. To me, this world has never been real. Even from the cradle, I've always felt that that was my world, and that I was here just for a little while of exile. Maybe many of you have felt that. But to me, it's so real that I live there. Yogananda said that he spent more time there than here. The more we live in the thought of that world, the easier it will be to be free. Higher still than that is God consciousness. And so it should not be that we live with attachment even to that world, because even that is just very low compared to the infinite light, the infinite bliss. But even so, to have those thoughts is worthwhile in helping to break the attachments to this world. It isn't only that things are more beautiful, it's also that the ability to appreciate those things is more beautiful. We live in a sort of prison in the physical body, in the human heart, where we can't enjoy, we can't break out. I remember one time up on top of Mount Waterman in Southern California, a brother disciple of mine, Norman, and I were sitting there one evening, and we were watching the sun go down in the west and lighting all, there was mist in the valleys, lighting all that mist in the valleys with this sort of golden hue. And the full moon was coming up in the east. And the moon was shining on the other side of us, on the same mist in the valleys to the east, with this beautiful ice blue. So in the west was this gold, and in the east was this blue, sort of silvery, icy blue. It was so thrilling. And I remember Norman sitting there and saying, "But if only I could feel it." And it's true. I was feeling a bit hungry and thinking about my dinner, and he was feeling the weight of his big body. And there was just, you can't break out of this cage as long as you're living in the body. You can't really enjoy this world completely until you can break out of the physical confines of a body and enter into a kind of rapport with it all, enter into a kind of sense of vibrating with it, of oneness with it. And this is the kind of state that one has there. Thus, the experience of it is far more intense, not only the objective beauty, but the ability to enjoy, the ability to feel. You will be drawn to that area where people live who are of similar mind. I've often felt that the people who have come to help build this community, that we were all together there and knew that this was a work we had to do. This is sort of the missing ingredient that we can't really offer as a reason for or a means of helping to build communities successfully. Why is Ananda so harmonious? You can't have that kind of harmony if you meet people just for the first time. Harmony, really deep harmony, is of a more soul level, and it's something that's developed over many incarnations. As Master said, you can't be close to someone unless you've known them for a long time, for many lifetimes. And so the natural harmony that exists here is due to an association that's a very long one. We can't tell people that very easily as one of the secrets for succeeding, because how are you going to do it? How are you going to guarantee it? And yet there are many places and many groups that I've been in, and even in the early days here at Ananda, I would feel like an outsider. I would see the first group of people who were here, and there were just a few, very few, that I felt were my own family. And the others, I would look at them and I'd say, "I don't belong here. This isn't mine." They were all trying to do basically the same thing. It wasn't right yet. And so the association that we have in starting this community even was very possibly born in that world, because Yogananda said that the things that people do in the way of, let's say, beautiful music, lovely paintings, books, noble deeds, and so on, building community, all of this would be an effort to recapture astral memories. That you have this knowledge inside, and you want to bring it to this world. And thus it is that Beethoven would write that lovely music. He's heard it before. You hear these things. Many composers have actually heard this music in their heads. Mozart The biggest problem for poor Mozart was writing it down. It was there right away. And then the drag of writing it all out was too boring. But the reality of it was something that came instantaneously. He'd hear it playing in his head. So, that world is, in a sense, a much more real world to every one of us, even if by false attachment and identification we have created a kind of reality for ourselves here. But it would help you to understand that truth so that you don't feel you're going into a foreign country, because when you go where you feel you belong, it's a lot easier to get rid of attachments to something here. To go with that thought that I'm going home is a very important aspect of becoming really free, really achieving salvation. Otherwise, what would you be saved from? You're saved from yourself. You're saved from your own anger and attachment and greed and negative emotions and so on. When you live in that world, the ordinary person who goes into that world goes temporarily. He still, if he has desires, he still has those sort of subconsciously present. And for a time, well, let me give you an illustration. When I went to India, I was enjoying being there completely. I was loving the music and loving being in the ashrams and chanting and mixing with devotees and so on. I remember after about a year and a half getting this craving to hear classical music again. And I went and bought some classical records and sat down and just thoroughly reveled in Beethoven's Sixth Symphony and other wonderful pieces of music. Or I remember one time at Mount Washington, after reading philosophy and all this stuff for about 3 years or so, and finally I just had to. I remember pulling the curtains in my room and closing the door and shutting the world out and opening up Shakespeare and just lying on the bed and reading Shakespeare with just sort of like inhaling joy, reading that wonderful poetry. And this kind of thing describes, although I hope that those thoughts of beautiful poetry and beautiful music are not necessarily as binding, nevertheless it illustrates how those subconscious habits work. And for a while you can leave them, and if you're in the astral world you can enjoy and live happily in communion with others, but then after a while comes this tug. You don't quite know what it is, because it's probably subconscious. But there's this tugging sort of desire which manifests itself to your consciousness there as intense moods, so that you no longer can really enjoy being there. There's something you're missing. At that time, you're ready to be drawn back. Now, what draws you back? Here's another very interesting aspect to the whole story. That when a couple unite sexually, and the sperm and ovum cells come together, that fusion generates a light in the astral world. And that light will be of a particular vibration. The vibration will be determined by the consciousness of the couple at the time of their union. So that if you come together lovingly, you'll attract a higher soul. If you come together passionately, you'll be more likely to attract a lower kind of soul. It's very complex, and it's not necessarily something that you can put your finger on clearly. It's not A or B. For example, a couple that come together passionately, if their basic consciousness is spiritual, there will be something spiritual even in that passionate union. But it will be much more clear, and the light will be much more clear, if you really come together with spiritual love. There was a couple who came to Yogananda and said they wanted a spiritual child. And he showed them a photograph of someone who, he said, it was that person had died, and it was time for that person to come back. And he said, if you will just refrain from sexual union for a while and build up your own magnetism, meditate together, and meditate on that soul, and invite that soul into your family. And then come together, consciously thinking of that soul and thinking of God. And he said that was in fact the soul that was drawn into their family. Very interesting. You will draw according to the quality of your magnetism, and when you're on that side, you will be attracted according to the quality of magnetism in the couple, in that particular flash of light. You will always be born into a family because of some affinity. It may be that a saint can be born to a criminal, but they will share one very strong quality in common they'll have. Maybe it will be a love for peace. Sometimes you'll find people who seem very different, but there will always be at least one quality that they have in common that's very strong, very pronounced in their makeup. Thus you find that in families very frequently there's some sort of familial trait that they all have. Another very interesting fact is that you're drawn by your magnetism, the magnetism of love, but love and hate are very similar. Hate too is a magnetism, and sometimes people are drawn together because they hate their parents or because they hate the people in that family. And you find some families where they're just fighting all the time. They've been drawn by that magnetism to fight it out at close quarters. Maybe that way they'll learn their lesson faster. But it's an important point to remember that the quality of your feeling, the quality of your love, the strength of it, will determine your future directions. If there is free, generous love in your heart, if there is kindness and forgiveness, this determines very much what you will learn. Is there a hell? Yes, of course there's a hell. If there's a heaven, there's got to be a hell. The alternative would be to have neither. And in the higher reality, neither exists. In the higher reality, as Jesus himself said, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. The underlying, he could have been speaking of Om, he could have been speaking of the deeper truth. But even heaven is temporary compared to that higher state. Ultimately, everything will be dissolved back in the spirit. When that time comes, where will you be? Everything is withdrawn into the spirit. Will you be completely saved forever? Or alternatively, having been saved and achieved liberation, will you have to come back into this world and start all over again? Maybe as a bug or something? No. Whatever state you've achieved, that is yours. That's your own, what you've earned. When the universe is manifested again, you will be put back into that state, and from that state you will have to grow. If you have achieved freedom, you don't have to come back at all, unless it be as a great avatar to help other people. Everything that you do, every good that you do, will be yours permanently. For example, there's that question that is asked in the Bhagavad Gita by Arjuna. What if a person takes up yoga and then leaves it? Wouldn't the bad karma that he accrues in leaving the path be even greater and overbalance the good that he accrued in coming onto the path? This is a question many people have asked. Krishna answers no. No good that you do is ever lost. The fallen yogi, if at the time of death he regrets his attachment to the world and is tired of the world, he will go into a high astral state and he'll live there for a long time. And when he's born into this world again, he'll be born into a spiritual family, or because it's difficult to be born into a spiritual family, at least there aren't that many, I guess is what he meant. He'll be born into a well-to-do home where he'll be able to work out his desires more quickly, come back to the path more quickly, and so on. The karma that you acquire in even a little bit of meditation is very, very great. Good karma. It's a much more conscious action, and therefore the good karma is much greater than just that which you get from helping somebody out of a ditch or something. A little bit of meditation even is enough to determine a very high state. But unless you're pretty highly advanced, you don't have enough awareness to be able to advance spiritually in the astral world. For most people, unless they're quite high spiritually, they must come down to this world. That's why many people on the spiritual path come back quickly, because they think, why should I waste my time enjoying this place? I want to get on with it and learn my lessons and become free from my karma. So yogis may come back very soon also. Materialists come back quickly, and yogis may come back quickly if they choose to. But normally speaking, as I say, you're not conscious enough. Let's put it this way. Here, you're surrounded by people of such diversity, murderers, thieves, selfish people, hateful people, nervous people, people dying of terrible diseases. There's so much pain and suffering, so much violence and hatred, that you're given a great deal of incentive to try to find something better. But supposing suddenly all these ills were wiped away and the whole world became just perfect, so perfect that you don't even have a heavy physical body to feed and breathe and keep clothed and protect from cold and heat, and you feel a much greater freedom, and you're able to just walk through forests reveling in the green beauty and bathe in streams and revel in the freshness of them and just go out under the rain and have rainbow lights pouring down on you. It's so beautiful, in fact, that the tendency is to think, gosh, this is enough, I've got it made. And it requires a pretty high degree of awareness to realize that that still is nothing. And so you don't have the incentive to try. And you just enjoy your karma, your good karma for a while, and when that's exhausted and the time to come back to this world arrives, then you have to start all over again. It's only if you can go in a high state of awareness, like Sabhikalpa Samadhi, and you are aware of this high Samadhi, and you're aware of the infinite bliss of God within and without, that you can see, well, after all, what's a rainbow river? Pretty dull stuff. And so there is that quality. Also, of course, because you have more love and more joy, there is that sort of thread that you can follow. And bit by bit, it may take longer, but bit by bit people can advance there. But it may take a very long time on that plane of existence, just because things are so much sweeter, so much more beautiful. Well, here's where the hard work can be done. So don't be rushing off and jumping off a bridge. In fact, the kind of karma that you get for jumping your prison sentence, you're put in for the old sentence plus some. The worst karma a person can get, usually, is suicide. Even worse than murder. Because murder is not a total denial of life. Suicide is. Unless it's for a high purpose. If you were to give up your life for somebody else, if you were to give it to save your country or something like that, a hero's death is a high kind of death. You go to a high astral region for the reason that you have died with such non-attachment to your body that you were willing to give it up for a cause. This is a very high kind of freedom. So the manner in which you die is very important. To be able to die a martyr's death, to be able to die a hero's death, is, in fact, a great blessing and not to be shirked. But how to prepare, finally? The way to prepare is right now. The time to prepare is right now. The way to prepare is the tools are right to hand. Learn to die daily, as St. Paul said. Learn to meditate so deeply that you can actually rise above body consciousness, your heart and lungs and all physical things just quieten down or still themselves completely. Or just in meditation, become aware, behind the flesh walls of your body, become aware of the movements of energy in your body. This is why the energization exercises are good too, because they make you aware of your body as a body of energy. Anything that you can do to diminish your identification with matter and to deepen your identification with that which is behind matter, the inner energy, the inner light, the inner joy, communing with the inner sound, the more you can feel the divine presence within you, the freer you will be. Every night, therefore, as I was saying earlier, feel that you're throwing everything back, you're giving everything back to God, nothing is mine. Think to yourself, supposing I don't wake up in this body in the morning, it would be a very good mental practice to prepare daily for death. It's the one certainty in life. You might as well live with that thought and not keep trying to push it aside and get embarrassed because you don't like to think about it. Enjoy thinking about it. Bring yourself to the point where you realize that I'm not this body. It doesn't matter whether I go or not. And yes, there will be some sadness, but let it be sadness for others, not for yourself. Most important of all is that when you go, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, those who worship the lower gods go to their gods. Those who worship me come to me. Don't go with roseate dreams of an astral paradise. Go rather with that thought of, I want to unite my soul with God. Have devotion to God. This is what you really are, is His child. And go always into the thought of Him. The thought of the astral world is a wholesome means of breaking identification with a lower reality. But most important of all would be to have that thought of God. If you have that when you die, if you're able to cling to Him, then when you go, you will unite your soul with Him and be eternally free. The personality isn't really yourself. The father of Loredano, who is one of our friends from Sorrento who came here, he died in December, and I was there just before and after his death. I wasn't there at the death. He was a very nice man. He was very humble, simple, sweet. You'd have to struggle to say more. He didn't seem like a great man. He didn't seem like an angelic being. He was a lawyer, a simple person who took care of his family. And in that way I knew him. What was extraordinary to all of us was the presence in the room where his body was laid out before burial. Because it was so sweet and angelic and powerful that suddenly you could see that that was what he really was. And the personality was a cloak for a spirit that was much greater. Remember that you are not just this body or the personality that you've acquired in living in this body. Master said at a Kriya initiation, the first one I ever attended, there will be, of those present today, there will be a few siddhas and quite a few jivanmuktas. Siddha means perfectly free, in the way he put it. And jivanmukta means one who has attained freedom from any further karma. Somebody who's certainly free from needing to come back to this plane. And I think of the people that I knew, and I think, well, gee, they don't seem that way. They're all very good. They're all very pure-hearted, but I don't see more. And yet, this is the experience that when their work is done, they've got a certain work to do. Like Vivekananda wasn't allowed to go back into samadhi as long as his work was there to be done. Ramakrishna said, I'm keeping the key in my pocket. When your work is done, then you will know who you really are. But Ramakrishna had this vision of Vivekananda that he saw himself as a little child, and he approached seven great sages, and he said, the one of them looked at him with a smile, and he said, it's time for me to go back, will you come too? And the sage smiled. That was Vivekananda, who was a great sage, who came down and had to live an ordinary worldly life for a while, and beautiful drama, but still, he wasn't in that consciousness while doing this work. So, remember, it takes very good karma to be on the spiritual path. It takes very good karma to have discovered the importance of meditation. It takes very good karma to want to know God instead of just live in this world having fun, kicking up your heels, until finally you kick the bucket. Don't sell yourself short. You have very good karma to be here today because it indicates that you want the highest truth. Don't blow it. This is the time you can work, and no matter when you start in life, you can achieve that same state if you work at it from now on. Love God more deeply and live for Him and realize that He is the only reality. That's how to prepare for death. When the time of death comes, if you've had this state, practiced it all your life, it'll be second nature to you to just automatically give yourself to Him. But otherwise, well, your karma will pull you down. There's a statement which Ramakrishna corroborated, and I frankly find difficult to believe. But anyway, here it is. That anybody who dies in Benares will be saved. Now, saved from what? I'm not quite sure. But Ramakrishna saw on the Ghat Shiva and Uma, I believe it was, coming and cutting the ties themselves. And somebody in India told me a very curious story in that regard. He said there was a dacoit who knew that he was getting old and decided that he'd beat the system. He knew that he'd been an evil man all his life, but he figured if he could die in Benares, it wouldn't matter. And so he cut his legs off. And in that way, he figured he'd never be able to move. And he went to Benares to do it, and he figured he'd die there. And one day, he saw somebody riding a horse, and badly, and he said, "Oh, look at you," he said, "even without my two legs I could ride better than that." And so they hoisted him up on the horse. He wanted to prove that he could ride better, and the horse took off, bolted. And just as it got outside the confines, the boundary of Benares, it threw him, and he broke his neck and was killed. That was supposed to be a true story. So, curious anyway, but the weight of your karma, which is the real point that I want to make here, will pull you down so that you can't say, "Well, at the last minute I'll think of God, ha ha ha, it doesn't matter what I do." Because the way you live will determine also how you go. So these two things need to be remembered. Live right, meditate deeply, love God, try to live only for Him, and secondly, remember that when that moment comes, don't be weeping for this body. Say, "I don't need it. I am your child. I want only you." And then with that dual effort, the daily effort now and the strong effort then, you will be able, perhaps even at that moment, to be completely free, and if not, at least to go into a very high state of consciousness. The most important thing you can do in your life is to prepare for that final exam.